Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this Honorable Court.
Thank you. Please be seated. Good morning. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket which have been consolidated for argument. The matters are docket number 04-1144, Shirley Neely in her official capacity as Texas Commissioner of Education and others versus West Orange Cove Consolidated Independent School District and others. Docket number 05-0145, Alvarado Independent School District and others versus Shirley Neely. And 050148, Edgewood Independent School District versus Shirley Neely. The court has allotted 60 minutes for Commissioner Neely and others, 40 minutes for West Orange Cove Consolidated ISD, and 20 minutes combined for the Edgewood and Alvarado Independent School Districts. The court will take a brief recess after West Orange Cove's oral submission. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the argument should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day. The court is ready to hear argument from the appellant, Commissioner of Education, Shirley Neely.
May it please the court, Mr. Ted Cruz will present argument for appellant Neely et al. Appellants have reserved 15 of the 60 minutes for rebuttal.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Education matters. From the very first days of the Republic of Texas, our Declaration of Independence has proclaimed the vital role of education to the future of Texas. Accordingly, our Constitution accords special protection to education and assigns the responsibility of providing for education to the Texas legislature. This case concerns three issues: adequacy, tax, and efficiency. My argument will address each in turn. Beginning with the first argument, adequacy, the state's arguments are twofold. First, we argue that adequacy is non-justiciable. It presents a political question that the Texas Constitution assigns to the Texas legislature and not to the courts. And second, that given Texas's longstanding, demonstrated extraordinary results, the system is, at the very least, rational, which survives this court standard laid out in Mum versus Mars and in Edgewood 4 and in the West Orange Cove decision. Beginning with the political question argument, in Edgewood 3, some 13 years ago, the majority of this court observed, quote, "We do not contemplate that our review of the school finance system in this litigation will continue indefinitely." Justice Cornyn, in that opinion, was even more graphic, observing that this case, if it has not already, will become like the notorious, albeit fictional, case of Jarndyce versus Jarndyce, Dickens's case that never ends, and he went on to observe, "We may begin to wonder if we have been assigned to some judicial purgatory where we must hear the same case over and over again." That was in 1992, 13 years ago. With respect to the question of adequacy, this court has never had before it an adequacy case on the merits.
But we've crossed this bridge, haven't we? I mean, we've said that we're going to review these standards as imprecise as they may be, that the court has an obligation to review a constitutional flaw.
Justice O'Neill, the court has crossed the bridge with respect to efficiency. And we will admit that our argument on political question is asking the court to reconsider pre-existing precedent.
But in Edgewood 4, didn't we say all three, adequacy, suitability, and efficiency?
There is language to that effect, but the court also explicitly said that adequacy had been severed and there was not an adequacy case before it. And this court cannot make a binding rule on justiciability without having before it an adequacy challenge. This is the first adequacy challenge on the merits that's been before the court.
So you're saying that there was dicta?
It was.
So if your point about non-justiciability of adequacy is correct, then that constitutional standard cannot be legally enforced.
It cannot be enforced in court, but that constitutional standard remains.
Which means it cannot be legally enforced, correct?
Incorrect, because enforcing a right in court is not the only way to enforce it. The text of the Constitution explicitly assigns it to the legislature of the state of Texas. And the fact that a right is non-justiciable does not mean it ceases to exist or have real meaning. It simply means that the Constitution has assigned a coordinate branch the responsibility for administering and determining it. It remains a real constitutional limitation. It is simply not the role of the courts. It is rather the role of the judiciary to apply it.
Where would the legal parameters for the boundaries of adequacy then come from?
One of the critical reasons why we suggest that adequacy is a political question is because there are no clear legal boundaries for what is and isn't adequate. School finance cases are not unique to Texas. Most of the states in the country have faced them. And there's a real divide in terms of what the Supreme Courts of the states have done. Some states, most notably New York and New Jersey, have made the decision to dive in and to say, we the courts will decide adequacy. And the result has been consistent. When courts have done that, they have become mired in a continual trap because...
Well, some have. I mean, wouldn't you agree the vast majority of states nationwide have decided to weigh in but give great deference to the legislature in making the policy choices?
If the court rejects the argument that it is a political question, it will do so only on the basis that the court will find a clear judicial standard that is administrable. And we suggest the only standard that has been suggested that even arguably meets that test is rational basis. And so those courts that have managed to avoid the trap of New Jersey, and I would note the court in particular on page 38 of our brief, to the passage we quote from the Rhode Island Supreme Court in 1995, describing the experience of New Jersey, which for 31 years, in the words of the Rhode Island court, the volume of litigation and the extent of judicial oversight in New Jersey provides a chilling example of the thickets that can entrap a court that takes on the duties of a legislature.
But now, the districts put that up as a case that sort of is on the edge. Let's talk about Massachusetts.
Okay. Massachusetts is a terrific case to talk about on two levels. First of all, because two justices in Massachusetts concurred specifically on the ground that adequacy is non-justiciable. And I would note, although that did not carry a majority in Massachusetts, the courts in Illinois and Alabama and Rhode Island and Florida and Pennsylvania have all concluded, have all taken what we would suggest is the more prudent path, to say that adequacy is tremendously important, but it is the legislature and not the courts that has to apply it. Likewise, in Massachusetts, two justices agreed with that. The plurality of the court in Massachusetts took the other path we urge, which is to say it is justiciable, but only in ascertaining whether or not the legislature has a rational basis. And that is the only hope of a judicially manageable standard.
Have we articulated the standard to be if the legislature has substantially defaulted on its obligation to carry out the constitutional dictate? How is that different from your conception of the rational basis standard?
Mr. Chief Justice, it is not different. That was the articulation in Edgewood 4. In Edgewood 4, also, the court quoted the court's precedent in Mum versus Mars, which provides the legislative determination of the methods, restrictions, and regulations is final, except when so arbitrary as to be violative of the constitutional rights of the citizens.
So if we determine that there was, that the record supports a substantial default here, then you would agree that we have responsibility to oversee that constitutional deprivation?
That would be true only if the court determines first the question is justiciable, that there is a clear objective standard. And the basic question is, what is the legal standard that a court applies to determine whether education is enough or not enough? And the problem every court that's tried to do this has had is there's no legal rubric to measure that against. And indeed, the representation of the parties says a lot. West Orange Cove, on page 110 of their brief in footnote 69, says, quote, it is impossible to identify a single dollar figure for what is a general diffusion of knowledge. Alvarado says, quote, on page 18 of their brief, no particular level of scrutiny is necessary. And Edgewood, in a heading on page 28 of their brief, says, quote, "The trial court properly abandoned the accountability rating system as the touchstone for measuring whether an adequate educational system exists." All three of the plaintiff groups are embracing the notion that there is no clear objective legal standard. Rather, what they urge this court to do is to set up the courts, much like the New Jersey court and the other courts that have done this, as the final arbiter of education policy.
Why is it so much different from so many other standards that courts have to apply? Reasonable person, good faith, due process, terms that, while they have broad meanings and people can differ over them to some extent, nevertheless have some meaning.
Because all of those terms are applied to specific individual circumstances. Reasonableness, for example, in the tort context of an injury between two parties, or in the criminal context of an individual search and seizure. Those are specific individual fact circumstances where a court can assess the facts and base it on developing standards of the common law. It's qualitatively different where, at the end of the day, what all of the plaintiff districts are aligned in is they are asking the courts of the state of Texas to order the legislature to raise taxes and spend more money.
Is that in their prayer for relief anywhere? I've heard that espoused, but what is their prayer for relief in this case?
Their prayer for relief is to enjoin the system. But if the court enjoined the system because
to enjoin the system from what? Isn't their prayer for relief to enjoin the state from paying money or using money in an unconstitutional manner?
It is, Justice Johnson, but if they prevail on adequacy, this court's opinion would have to say the system is not adequate. And as West Orange Cove is very candid in their brief, they say on page 99 of their brief, quote, "All adequacy claims ultimately are about inputs, specifically money." So there should be no doubt about what this fight is about. The plaintiffs want this court to order the legislature to spend more money. And if this court enjoins the system, unless and until the legislature spends more money, it is functionally the same as ordering the legislature to appropriate additional funds.
But isn't that a continuum as well? I mean, in Edgewood 4, we said if the legislature can't define what constitutes a general diffusion of knowledge so low as to avoid its obligation to suitably provide. What if the state defined standards but gave no money to fund them, or money that clearly could not accomplish the mandate that the legislature has given? There's got to be some point at which the court can determine adequacy.
Respectfully, Justice O'Neill, if it is a political question, as Illinois and Rhode Island and Pennsylvania and Florida and Alabama have all concluded, then the remedy is in the legislature.
And but if it's not, if there's some floor we can review.
If the court determines adequacy is justiciable, then the test that this court has laid out is whether the system the state has in place satisfies a rational basis. None of the plaintiffs like that test.
And so under my scenario, there would be no rational basis if there were mandates and no funds to meet those mandates.
That is correct, although under the approach this court laid out in Edgewood 4, the focus is on the outputs, not on the inputs. This court considered whether to examine inputs to specifically say, is there enough money? Are teachers getting paid enough? Are these books too old or not too old? Is the library big enough? And the court said, those inquiries are a morass from which the court cannot escape. And so in terms of applying the rational basis analysis, the inquiry should be, is the system as a whole producing outputs?
Well, how much of that inquiry is forward-looking and how much is retrospective? So that if you know, let's say the legislature enacted some mandates with no funding to go along with them at all, do we have to wait until the system fails, or can we examine inputs at some threshold level?
Under this court's Edgewood 4 decision, the examination is on outputs. And given that there is a consistent pattern for over 10 years of regularly raising the bar and student achievements regularly rising, there would be no basis for this court to conclude that the system is irrational.
West Orange Cove argues in its brief that, and there's a chart on page 17, that with the exception of sixth grade Hispanic students, there is not a single grade between grades 5 and 11 in which a simple majority of Hispanic, African American, economically disadvantaged, or limited English proficiency students was able to pass all tax tests at the panel recommended levels. Now, is this the sort of output that you are asking the court to review?
Mr. Chief Justice, this chart in West Orange Cove's brief is highly misleading, because what they have done is they have taken the 2004 results and they've applied the 2005 standards. So that chart is not what actually happened in 2004. That chart said, and remember, this is a system where everyone agrees, the plaintiffs and defendants agree, the rational way to do it, the educationally sound way to do a new system, is to phase in scores. So each year you raise the standard. And what they asked is, if the 2004 results were applied under the much higher standard, here's what would happen. That assumes that all of the students learn nothing in the year between 2004 and 2005. And the best proof of how misleading this chart is the actual 2005 results are not these, and they are markedly better. The pattern in the state of Texas has been consistent improvement for over a decade.
I mean, if there is not consistent improvement, and let's say the chart is correct and we're constant over a period of a decade, would you concede that the court is obligated by its constitutional responsibility to intervene if a case is properly before the court?
Not necessarily. For example, the plaintiff districts put a great deal of reliance on the fact that the current passing rate for the science test is 25%. And they argue 25% means 75% of the students are flunking it. That is inherently irrational. The problem with that argument is any pass rate for any test means nothing in the abstract. It only has meaning when compared to the questions on the test. 25% may be a terrific pass rate on a very difficult test, and 90% may be a lousy pass rate on a really easy test.
Mr. Cruz, an amicus filed by the Earl Carle Institute for Legal and Social Studies, on page 5 of their brief, it indicates that if we're looking at outputs here, that Texas ranks fifth lowest rate in the nation as far as students going to college. The transition rate for African American and Hispanic students is even lower. Are those outputs that the court should consider to determine whether or not the system has failed?
Texas faces a challenging student body population to educate. And in the face of a challenging student body population to educate, a student body population that faces language difficulties, that faces recent immigration difficulties, that faces socioeconomic challenges, Texas's pattern of success has been extraordinary. For example, on the NAEP, which is the National Assessment of Educational Progress, which is one of the plaintiff school districts described that as, quote, the gold standard. And all of the plaintiff's experts agree the NAEP is the single best national measure of educational achievement. Texas in 2000, Texas 4th and 8th graders ranked first in the nation in math. In 2002, Texas 4th graders were first in the nation in reading. And most importantly for your question, Justice Medina, in 2003, Texas ranked first in the nation in closing the gap between African-American and white fourth graders in math, and second in the nation in closing the gap between Hispanic and white fourth graders in math and in reading. Those results are extraordinary. Indeed, the West Orange Cove's own expert, Dr. Grismer, described Texas's results on the NAEP as the first in the nation overall. That is what makes their argument all the more extraordinary. A system that is producing some of the best results in the nation, and in particular some of the best results for minority students facing serious socioeconomic and language challenges, that system is being emulated by states throughout the country, and yet their argument is that system that is at the top in the country is nonetheless constitutionally inadequate. That stretches the language of the Constitution beyond where it would get.
But it doesn't say that there's no standard. It just says that we can disagree about whether it's met. But it seems like there emerges from the evidence here and the party's positions the parameters of a standard that while there's a great deal of disagreement about where the case falls in the middle, nobody is suggesting that an adequate system would not teach English or teach math or teach science. All of these things have to be component parts. And so coming back to the standard issue, it's not clear to me why that's not as much of a standard as courts have to wrestle with in many other contexts.
Justice Hecht, I agree that if this court applied rational basis with some real deference to the legislature, which is the path Massachusetts took, that that would come the closest to a judicially manageable standard.
And, of course, we've never said rational basis, but I'm wondering whether that fits very well here, because it's pretty easy to see that there are legitimate judgment calls. Coming back to the Chief Justice's question, is it more like substantial default, or is there kind of a... It's not just could reasonable minds think this up. It's that at the end of the day, when you've heard all of the evidence, do you come away with the conviction that we just have not met what we said we were going to meet?
Respectfully, we would suggest that substantial default and arbitrary under Mum versus Morris and rational basis are all the same thing. If they're not, if they involve more of an examination of the merits, we would submit that that is putting each district court in the state of Texas in the role of policymaking. Because there is no right answer as to whether teachers need to be paid what they're paid now or $1,000 more. There is no legal answer as to whether a given book is too old or is not old enough. There is no legal answer as to whether the way to improve education is to spend more money or to introduce fundamental reforms such as something like a school choice program. All of those are pure policy questions.
But they get to the edge at some point. I mean, while I think you make a good point that it's hard to decide whether to pay teachers $1,000 more or $1,000 less, it's not so hard a point to say should we pay them a third as much or three times as much. At some point, you get to the edges.
At some point, an examination of rational basis, one would reach a system that was not rational. What we have presented in our argument is that given the methodology whereby the system was developed, given the fact that it involved hundreds of educators, community leaders, it involved the entire system spending years developing an educational system, given that the results have been consistently among the best in the nation, given that other states are modeling their programs after Texas's, that by any measure, this system is so far beyond the threshold of rational as to be exemplary. And so any standard that is applied, the Texas system we would submit satisfies. If I may turn to the tax case.
Can you address standing briefly?
With respect to standing, this court in West Orange Cove recently rejected the standing argument. And it did so by a vote of 8-1 with 1-7 votes.
As you said, there was no adequacy challenge in West Orange County.
And the argument we've presented on standing is that in order to have standing, an individual plaintiff must have a concrete, real injury. And in this instance, the districts are not alleging their own rights. Rather, they are alleging the rights of their taxpayers.
The Article 7 of the Constitution that provides for that the legislature shall make a suitable provision for support and maintenance of an efficient system of public free schools. Is that a constitutional right that's intended to protect school districts or school children?
By the terms of it, we would suggest that it is designed to protect school children.
And how many school children are involved in this case?
There are none that are plaintiffs to this case.
And in Edgewood 1, 2, and 3, where we addressed adequacy, there were school children.
Absolutely.
And that makes a difference or not?
Well, the majority of the court in West Orange County found fault with the state not having previously raised standing. And we responded that given that there were individual plaintiffs in all of those cases, raising standing was not dispositive.
West Orange Cove, when you're talking about state property tax, the constitutional provision in Article 8 that says no state property tax because we're going to leave that for the districts to tax. Good reason to give districts standing there because they need to protect their own revenue. That is for school districts, not necessarily school children. Have we ever said they're standing for school districts to determine adequacy in a case where there were no, let me, how many school children testified at this trial?
I'm not aware there were no
any parents from Edgewood or Alvarado testified.
I'm not aware of any.
So we just did a trial with nobody but school employees, school experts, and state experts. None of the actual people that are in these poor districts were there to say whether this is what they wanted to do or not. Not one.
That is my understanding.
But then again, one of the arguments the districts make is that you've put mandates on us that are unfunded, so we cannot meet these mandates. That would be, I would think they would have standing to at least raise the issue that we don't have the resources that you've that we need to reach these results.
Well, except that argument is belied by the facts because the districts are meeting those levels and the students are achieving.
But in terms of asserting claims for standing purposes, that's the standing issue as they frame it.
But their claim is not based upon statutory bases. It's a constitutional claim. They are claiming there's a violation of the text of the Texas Constitution. And the Texas Constitution protects school children. It does not protect school districts, which are a subdivision of the state.
What's your definition of adequacy? Can you put it in a sentence?
The only definition the Constitution uses is a general diffusion of knowledge. And a general diffusion of knowledge, we would suggest this court has used language such as a basic, a minimum education. Beyond that, we would suggest it is impossible to judicially define the contours of what is and isn't a basic minimum education, short of engaging in policymaking.
The trial judge pointed to the state board and the legislature's mandates regarding Texas curriculum requirements, the recommended high school program, and then certain enrichment programs. You disagree, I take it, with the trial judge's explanation of what adequacy means, even though the board, school board, and the legislature mandated certain curriculum requirements.
Yes, Justice Wainwright, and for two reasons. First of all, you are right. In conclusion of Law 7, the trial judge defined a general diffusion of knowledge with reference to the state statutory education provisions. That approach was explicitly rejected by this court in Edgewood 4, where the same argument was made that these statutory provisions define what is required, and this court said, quote, the legislature's funding obligations are generally limited to what it appropriates, regardless of what it promises in other statutes. And that is on page 736 of Edgewood 4. So first of all, what the trial court did is contrary to this court's precedent. But secondly, what the trial court did makes no sense because it establishes a perverse incentive for the state not to reach high. The state should endeavor to produce the best education humanly possible. But if the plaintiff's standard applies, anytime the state tries to do something, it will be sued if it doesn't reach perfection. Anytime it raises the bar, under the trial court's theory, under the plaintiff's theory, the constitutional floor rises right up to that bar, and so the incentive is to keep the bar as low as possible.
But you state, I think, accurately in brief, that the Constitution does not mandate perfection. Are you arguing that the Constitution mandates mediocrity?
The Constitution mandates a general diffusion of knowledge.
Which is?
A basic minimum education, which is the language this court has used in Edgewood 3, in Edgewood 4. That's how it has discussed it. And the state commendably aims for much more than a basic minimum education.
But doesn't that rise over time, Mr. Cruz? I mean, 100 years ago, basic education would have been reading, writing, and arithmetic. Now, to get into college, you have to understand calculus, you have to have a foreign language, you have to have all these sciences to meet the basic minimum requirements to achieve.
Sure, that does change in time, and this court has said so.
And when these mandates are given, and perhaps unfunded, it may very well be a political question, but how are the schools to rise to that level of expectation if they can't garner the revenue to fund these mandates?
The clear record of performance demonstrates that they have done just that.
They met the minimum requirements.
They have met the minimum requirements over, and not just met the minimum requirements, but the Texas system for the better part of a decade, the pattern that Texas has followed so successfully, is each year making the tests harder, each year raising the standards, and gradually seeing student performance, district performance, campus performance clear that next hurdle. That has been the consistent pattern for over a decade. It remains true in 2005. All of the plaintiffs' arguments about saying the districts can't meet these standards, the students can't meet these standards, are directly refuted by the fact that they keep meeting the standards, and the standards keep going up every single year.
Counsel, the trial court made findings of fact, and I don't find in the record where the state requested any additional findings of fact. And many of those findings of fact are that, for example, the plaintiffs, various plaintiffs in the focus districts, lack sufficient funds to provide an adequate education. Now, those are findings of fact. Are we bound by those, or is it your position that as a matter of law, this record demonstrates that the state has met the constitutional standard?
Our position is the latter. The state did not request additional findings of fact, and the fundamental error with what the district court did is it applied the wrong legal standard. It applied a legal standard that is contrary to what this court has laid out in Mum versus Mars, and Edgewood 4, and West Orange Code. And in particular, it examined all of the inputs, and it made its own policy determination about what was and wasn't good educational policy for the state of Texas. That is directly contrary to the approach this court has laid out.
And let me talk to you about procedure just a moment. Is it not the rule that we have when the trial court makes findings, that if those findings are unchallenged, then we are bound by those findings here and any implied findings that go along with those.
That is true.
To support the judgment.
That is true, but only to the extent that the findings are factual in nature. Whether the system is adequate is a legal judgment.
But if the trial court found the state lacks sufficient, the plaintiffs lack sufficient funds to provide the education, is that not a fact finding?
What the trial court found is the state lacks, or the districts lack sufficient funds to meet its definition of adequacy, what it believed was required, which is very different from the legal standard. And so its fact finding is that the facts do not meet the wrong legal standard. That is not binding on this court.
In one of the fact findings, I recall the trial court found that the state, that the plaintiffs lacked funds to provide a constitutional and or statutory accreditation, to meet the constitutional and or accreditation standards. Would that not cover both standards?
There is, with respect to the accreditation standard, there is no evidence that the districts cannot meet the accreditation standard.
So as a matter of, your position as a matter of law is, this evidence shows as a matter of law they have been met.
Correct.
Okay. No fact question at all.
Correct. The numbers are undisputed.
How about the constitutional standard?
The constitutional standard, there is a dispute, but the dispute is what's the appropriate legal rubric to measure. Because what the district court found is the facts did not meet its legal definition of an adequate education. And its legal definition of an adequate education was the trial court's own policy decision about what did and didn't make sense for educational policy in the state of Texas. That judgment is explicitly the judgment of the legislature. Indeed, in West Orange Code, this court said that precisely.
Let me then go. Is it your position now that that the constitutional standard has been met as a matter of law by the evidence in this record?
Absolutely. As this court noted in West Orange Cove, and indeed held, it is outside the scope of judicial authority to review the legislature's policy choices in determining what constitutes an adequate education. And we emphasize that courts cannot undertake to review those choices one by one or attempt to define in detail an adequate education. The over 600 findings of fact that the trial court issued was exactly what this court said in West Orange Cove a Texas court cannot do.
You were about to discuss the tax question. I think you're well familiar with a phrase from a prior opinion that if the floor and the ceiling come together, then there's no meaningful discretion. And the legislature could be held to have implemented an unconstitutional ad valorem, statewide ad valorem tax. Why is that not the case here when there are clearly a number of a majority, if you look at student populations of districts that have come to the $1.50 cap or within a few cents of that cap? Why is that not, why does that record not show us that there's been, in effect, a statewide tax?
Because the plaintiffs utterly failed to carry their burden of proof. There is a basic disagreement between the parties about what constitutes the floor. The fact that the districts are taxing, or many districts are taxing at $1.50 or near $1.50, is not dispositive of the legal question. The legal question that this court has set out is whether the state has forced them to do so. And so,
what additional money has the legislature appropriated? During these years, they've implemented tax, and there's the tax test, and there are promotional gates, and other standards that the state has required of districts. What additional money has the legislature appropriated to meet those new requirements?
The budget has consistently risen, and indeed has risen dramatically. In fact, if one compares, at the time of Edgewood 1 in 1989, the statewide budget was $12 billion. Now, 16 years later, it's almost $35 billion.
Has there the percentage of state money from general revenue equally risen over the years?
The percentage of state money has not equally risen, but the tax analysis this court has applied has not asked what is the percentage of state money. What this court's analysis has asked is whether the state so controls the levy, assessment, and disbursement of the rate that the districts lack meaningful discretion.
And the question is, as the requirements, and I think you're very careful in your brief to say the state has imposed rigorous requirements to benefit the students of our state. The requirements go up. There's no additional general revenue given to the states or to the school districts in order to meet that, so that they have to rely on property tax rates in order to achieve the standard that the legislature has imposed. And I guess my question is, and it's been presented in West Orange brief, have they not been required to tax at the maximum rate to meet standards imposed by the legislature?
There's no disputing that the state requirements have increased with the new curriculum and the new accountability standard. That being said, at trial, there was a basic disagreement between the parties, because the plaintiffs refused to meet their burden of proof that the expenditures they were making were required by the state. Rather, the standard they argued was anything the districts choose to spend money on, they had to spend money on. And it is worth considering, under their definition, this court has repeatedly talked about local enrichment, and yet under their definition, everything is required. It's unclear what possibly could be enrichment, because they argue every single expenditure that the district makes is required in some generic sense in the system.
Well, but you'd agree there's been some necessity for that, because, for example, to get an academically acceptable rating, you have to pay attention to the promotion gates, for example, whereas the districts are required to meet those promotion gates. So you've taken something out of the accountability system but made the schools meet it without giving them funds or objectives in which to meet.
Well, the aggregate funds, both from the districts and the state, have gone up. But secondly, we're not disputing that the requirements have increased, but what the plaintiffs failed to do, despite repeatedly being asked by the defendants to do so, is make any attempt to segregate their expenditures, those required by the states versus those that are local options.
Well, you'd agree that remediation is required by the state?
Yes.
And a lot of the measures that the school districts aren't strictly required to do are designed to address remediation.
Some of the measures are designed to address remediation, and they could have put on evidence that specific remediation programs were designed to meet state requirements. They chose not to do that.
But you would call any remediation efforts local preference?
No, no. If they put on evidence and prove up that they are expending money in order to meet state requirements, that it is the state legislature that's the decision maker, then that would properly count towards the floor.
Well, so summer school, to help those who haven't passed promotion gate tests, is that a local preference?
If they had put on evidence that that was designed and was producing results to meet state requirements, then it would qualify. Instead, what they simply put on was their school districts, the superintendents, who asserted one after the other that every expenditure was designed, for example, to minimize dropouts. I mean, that's a theory that proves so much. One of the focus districts, Socorro, erected an enormous outside water slide, and that was justified as, well, it reduces dropouts because the kids like the water slide. That argument, if it is the case that anything the districts decide to spend money on is nebulously required, it means the state has no ability to ever prevent there from being a statewide property tax. Because if the cap raises to $2 or $3, the districts can just spend their way up to that level and argue they're required to spend that.
But is there any suggestion that they would? I mean, from a historical perspective, if you draw back and look at what's happened, 10 years ago, the districts were not bunched up around the cap. They were all spread out. And it seems from the record that if there weren't a cap, or if it were much higher, once again, they'd all be spread out. Some would go higher, some would stay put, some would go down. Isn't that bunching up, just the phenomenon of it, some indication that the state has controlled that maximum level?
It is certainly true the state has controlled the maximum. And the question upon which the parties fundamentally disagree is whether the state has controlled the minimum. We would agree that the requirements have increased, but what they haven't demonstrated, this court said the two become one, or effectively so there's no meaningful discretion. The districts chose to make no effort to segregate any of their expenditures and say these are state requirements, these are not. Justice Heck, you asked if there's any indication that it would go up if the cap raised. Well, one of the West Orange Cove experts, Lynn Moe, who's a former employee for the state of Texas, explicitly advised his client school districts, raise your tax rate up to the cap because that maximizes your state money. And that's in the record in Volume 9 of the reporter's records at page 134.
Right, but that's at $1.50. And it's not clear to me the same thing would be true if the cap were $5. At some point, the local taxpayers might not put up with it.
That may well be true. And it's certainly true that the taxpayers have to approve a tax increase, and so that may constrain what the districts do. But the legal test that this court has applied for whether a tax and a system is an unconstitutional statewide property tax is whether the decision maker on the levy, assessment, and disbursement, and this court has used all three and the conjunctive, not the disjunctive, is so controlled by the state that there is no meaningful discretion. And yet, as we go through in our brief, in about 12 pages of our brief, every district is making a host of discretionary decisions. They're all different. And our argument is not that those expenditures are bad. Those expenditures may be terrific. They may be benefiting the students. They may be responding to desires of their community. But they're all different. Each district decides to do different ones. And in none of those expenditures is the state requiring. So under the test...
Well, but let's talk again about the promotion gates and the accelerated instruction that is required. I think you just said that there could be some programs implemented that you would not consider local preferences. Tell me what one of those would look like.
Well, the example you gave, Justice O'Neill, about summer school.
So what would a district have to do to justify summer school? I mean, at what point do you start parsing these down? If they said we need full-time kindergarten, you say that because that's not required, it's a local preference. But what if the district said we need full-time kindergarten to get kids ready to pass the fourth grade promotion gate? How do you divide the line between local preference and...
Beyond the simple assertion from the superintendent that every single expenditure, and I would note, one superintendent said with respect to the outsourcing of school buses, which some districts have saved over $1 million by outsourcing school buses, one of the superintendents responded, well, having the school bus drivers as district employees helps our students not drop out, because the drivers feel more part of the community, and so it's required by the state that we not outsource our school bus drivers.
So your argument is that if there's any fat in the system at all, remediation programs, you can't look at them. In other words, if you can cut your transportation budget, it doesn't matter if you've got remediation programs.
With respect to remediation, had the districts put on evidence that facing significant challenges in terms of the promotion gates, in terms of dropouts, that these programs were affirmatively working to do that, they were designed to do that, they were targeted to the students that needed it, and they were working, that could well have proven up a case that they go to the floor. The districts made the decision not to prove up that case, rather just to assert everything.
But your argument would then be, okay, you've made the case that that goes to the floor, but there's some fat on another side that you need to deduct from the floor.
That's correct. And one example of that is, for example, Dallas ISD, which has a local property tax exemption of 10%, which is the equivalent of 5 cents in their property tax. Dallas is the only one of the West Orange Cove focus districts. There were 9 focus districts. The other 8 have all eliminated their optional homestead exemption. Dallas testified that they believed that would be politically problematic. Whether it is or isn't, that's not a requirement from the state. And it can't be the case that the district can simply tax themselves into a lawsuit.
Let me ask again. You said the 89 figures state education budget was $12
billion? Yes, Justice Brister.
And current $39
billion? That's correct.
Is that real dollars or same dollars, or I'm a little rusty on what's happened to the dollar.
I do not believe that is inflation adjusted. So I think that is nominal budget. So there is some inflation measured in that, but that is well beyond.
But assuming the dollar hasn't tripled in value between 89 and now, there's been an actual increase since that time.
That's correct. And those figures can both be found on the TEA website. They're in the public documents.
Does that include recapture funds?
It does. That's total expenditure in education.
Mr. Cruz, let's assume for your sake of argument that this is a political question for the legislature to decide, this adequacy issue. What if the legislature fails to act, as it did in the special session last year, certainly thus far? At what point, if at any point, would you envision this court getting involved in that issue?
If the court determines that adequacy is non-justiciable, it means that the responsibility is the exclusive responsibility of the legislature, which means that there is not a remedy in court, that it ultimately is left to the political processes and to the pressures from constituents and to the obligation the legislature feels to carry out its constitutional mandate.
And in your brief, you're also asking the court to essentially turn back some 19 years of decision-making and not involve itself in this political question.
That is correct. With respect to efficiency, altogether different issue, we do urge the court to reconsider its earlier decision and conclude that that also is a political question. Between the two, in my judgment, adequacy is much more clearly a political question than efficiency. Efficiency is a closer call. We are urging the court, in light of the experience in other states and in light of the demonstrated experience in Texas, to reconsider its precedent. But between the two, that is, at a minimum, a much closer call.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the appellant, Commissioner Shirley Neely. From the appellee, I'm sorry, West Orange County.
May it please the court, Mr. David Thompson will now present argument for appellees, West Orange Cove Consolidated Independent School District.
May it please the court. This court's prophetic warning in 1995 has come to pass. The state system of public education now relies so heavily on local property taxes for its primary support that the system now operates as if it is being supported by an unconstitutional state property tax.
Now, that argument does depend on how we measure the floor.
Absolutely, Your Honor. We agree with the state that the key issue is the definition of the floor. We completely disagree with the state's statement of the legal test or the factual measurement of that floor. It's very interesting, and I listened carefully. It's my understanding when this court has previously stated the standard. The standard is whether the state so controls the levy, assessment, and disbursement of local property tax revenues directly or indirectly that districts have no meaningful discretion. This court has stated that standard three times. Those key words, directly and indirectly, go to the heart of the discussion this court was just having about how you define the floor.
Well, how is it that your school districts have no discretion in dispersing their funds?
A disbursement speaks to the expenditure of the funds, Your Honor. Let me give you a good example of the criticalness of that, of the court's own standard of direct or indirect. The state spends a considerable amount of time in its briefing arguing that, well, the state sets a minimum salary schedule for teachers, and that's all the state requires. And every expenditure on salaries above that minimum, gosh, must be local discretion.
But where do you stop that? Because an argument can be made, well, let's pay a huge amount of money so that we'll get up to the floor. And
right.
I mean, at what point do you put a lid on that?
Your Honor, I think that there are obviously limits, but very candidly, I think the trial court and the findings in this case, and indeed the testimony of various witnesses, focused on very specific types of expenditures that are necessary to meet the state's own requirements.
It did, but those were a broad, broad range.
So some of them are broad, but the state's requirements are broad. As an example, the state requires all districts to employ certified and qualified teachers.
Is it significant that your expenditures were not segregated at the trial court?
No, Your Honor, we do not believe the segregation that the state is describing as key to our proof. We simply do not agree with that assessment. We think the record, the testimony, the expert testimony of superintendents, the other evidence in the record indicates that districts is taking all of the money in the current system to meet the state requirements.
Including water slides?
That testimony was not from one of our witnesses. I do not know the extent of the expenditure on water slides. I think if that's the case, it's an anecdotal instance and certainly it's not an indication of the overall system.
But your feeling is that there's not one school district in Texas that has a little bit of fluff in where they're spending their money.
Your Honor, I'm not going to represent to this court that every district in Texas is spending every single dollar on matters required to meet state requirements. That wasn't our argument, and we do not believe that was our burden at trial. We believe we did show that our plaintiffs, and indeed that it affects enough districts in the state, that it is systemic enough that the finding is inescapable that school districts in Texas must spend the money generated within the current system to meet state requirements. And proof came in a variety of different ways. So, for example, the studies by the Legislative Budget Board, which this court looked to in Edgewood 4, concluded that it takes basically all of the revenue being generated in the current system to meet the older, lower performance standards, to get 50% of the students in the district to meet the passing standards under the older, lower accreditation standards. So we think the proof of systemic exhaustion of capacity or an exhaustion of discretion with districts was well established.
Is it true that there are some districts that are cutting funds and expenditures currently while still taxing at the maximum rate, and how does that figure into your argument?
Your Honor, you are absolutely correct, and the evidence of our first witness at trial was Dr. Pat Forgeau from Austin, who testified about the terrible situation that districts find themselves in, where they are having to cut programs that they acknowledge are important for their students and important for meeting state requirements. Austin is in a particularly difficult position. It's the only district in our focus districts that is a recapture district. And Dr. Forgeau testified that Austin found themselves in the extraordinary position of having to reduce their budget and make cuts out of their own budget that they were spending on their own students at the very same time that their recapture payments were increasing.
Well, I want to backtrack and talk about the standing issue, which Justice Brister raised. I think it's very significant. Is it significant that there are no individual students named as parties in this litigation?
Your Honor, we do not believe that is significant.
And why not?
Because we believe this court has previously found that the districts themselves have standing to bring this exact complaint.
Where?
If you look at the Education Code, Section 11.002, it starts off by saying that the state has chosen school districts and has given school districts the primary responsibility to carry out the educational functions that actually belong to the state itself.
But you're not here claiming the current school finance system violates the Education Code. You're here saying it violates the Constitution.
We are here claiming that the implementation of the Education Code provisions, particularly Chapters 41 and 42, the funding provisions, do violate the Constitution.
Right, because if it doesn't violate the Constitution,
correct.
Well, that limits what our role in the system. Now, do you agree with Mr. Cruz that Article 7, Section 1 of the Constitution, providing for general diffusion, the legislature shall make suitable support? Is that a right that accrues and protects school districts or school children?
And the right ultimately belongs to children and indeed to citizens of the state of Texas.
None of whom are parties.
They are not parties, Your Honor. But again, we believe, looking at this court's prior decisions, that is not necessary.
Which decision?
The West Orange Code 1 decision.
Which was not an adequacy check. Article 7, it was an Article 8 case, correct?
That is correct. And Edgewood 4, which was an Article 7, Section 1.
I mean, the reason, it's not idle curiosity. I'm looking through Judge Deese's extensive findings of fact for why the school system is not adequate. And I see the putting aside the facilities issue, separate question, that it's inadequate because we need bigger bilingual stipends for teachers, bigger salaries, bigger signing bonuses, bigger loan forgiveness, more in-service training for teachers, more recruitment dollars for teachers, more librarians. Now, if we had 20 families from Edgewood School District and asked them, what's the three things you think make your schools inadequate, how many do you think would say librarians?
I do not know, Your Honor.
How many would say we just need more recruiting dollars for teachers?
I don't know.
And on the major fight in this case, do we look at inputs or outputs in determining adequacy? The districts fight strongly, with some support from our cases, saying we look at inputs. How much money are we getting? The state says we look at outputs. How are the kids doing on their tests? If we ask those 20 families from Edgewood, what would they say is wrong with their district? If they said, which would they prefer? Your kids do better on the tests, or the teachers make more money? Which one are they going to pick?
Your Honor, we don't believe that's an either-or question.
Well, you don't concede that you argue that the outputs are inaccurate. If they were accurate, and actually you could do a test, big if you could do a test that found out who was educated and who was not, That would be the test of a school system. Even if the state didn't spend a dime, if there was some invention where we could zap kids and they'd be all get into Harvard, that would be a great school system, even though no dollars went into it.
If. Yes, Your Honor.
Well, so isn't that a standing problem that we don't, that we have? Did any school parents or kids testify at this trial last 6 weeks?
The parents testified not as parents. A number of the witnesses, and I do want to make clear to the court, a number of the witnesses who did testify as experts on both sides, in fact, have children in the school.
Edgewood. Edgewood's the district that's been filing suits for 40 years. Did any parents of Edgewood kids come in and say, this is what's wrong with our school district, we need more librarians?
I do not know if their witnesses who testified were parents. None of them testified as parents as their primary qualification. Our view of adequacy, Your Honors, does not focus solely on inputs.
Well, you term it as opportunity, meaningful opportunity.
Yes, Your Honor.
And as I understand the state's argument, they don't quarrel with that so much, but they say that meaningful opportunity can only be measured by results. And if the results are steadily improving, how can you say that the students don't have a meaningful opportunity to meet state requirements?
Right. Two responses. First of all, Your Honor, we do not concede the state's somewhat rosy view of our progress that is occurring at present. And in particular, counsel took some exception to the chart on page 17 of our brief. As being inaccurate. It is not inaccurate.
All that aside, I mean, that strikes me as very policy-driven,
right,
as to what tests properly measure and which ones to give.
Right.
I mean, the TOCS test is significantly more difficult than the TOS test, and I suppose that the state could decide to stick with TOS and have high passing rates. And by ratcheting up the standards, it's going to result in low passing rates at the front end, but as long as steady improvements made, how can we say that no meaningful opportunity is given?
Your Honor, when you have 38% of 10th graders this year passing all tests that they will need to pass for graduation, when 22% of African-American 10th graders this year are passing in April 2005 at the standard necessary for graduation.
That's looking at it in a vacuum. That would require us to say constitutionally on a harder test, there's a violation. As long as steady improvement is shown, why isn't that a measure of adequacy?
Steady improvement is important. It's not a substitute.
You'd acknowledge that steady improvement has been made.
Steady improvement has been made in the past, but with a caveat, Your Honor. If you look at the progress under TOS from 1993-94, that school year, 9 years later, to 2001-2002, average passing scores raised approximately 30% of students passing all portions of the exam. Inflation-adjusted per-student expenditures went up 24%. The evidence presented is that there is a correlation and a positive correlation. Indeed, this court, going back to Edgewood 1, and we think you have consistently said there is a correlation between the quality of a child's education and the amount of money that is spent on that child.
But it's not dollar for dollar.
It is not dollar for dollar.
In the most recent years, there have been cuts in many districts' budgets, and yet it's not clear that how badly things have deteriorated or if they've deteriorated at all. In fact, it looks to me like, from a lot of the evidence, that some of these cuts should have been made a long time ago, that they've cut a lot of money out of a lot of different areas of their budgets and don't seem to have missed it very much.
Your Honor, in any organization, whether it's my law firm or a school district, I'm sure that efficiencies can and should be achieved. The testimony at trial from the comptroller's office, and multiple comptrollers have done performance reviews of school districts for years, have found that approximately 1% on average of school district revenues could be redirected more efficiently in another area. Now, some of the cuts that are being made, and I think this gets back to the definition of what is, what's the standard, what's the general diffusion of knowledge. And as this court has stated, the standard you've now stated twice, it's whether there's a substantial default on providing that education that would allow all students access to the education program so that they may fully participate.
But again, how do you measure that?
You measure access by outputs. Results.
Well, and on the input side, it's hard for me to see anything that wouldn't be covered with policy determinations that it's not the province of the courts to get involved in.
And Your Honor, we're not asking, and I think that there is a difference between our position and the state. We are not asking this court to constitutionalize all of those inputs. What we are saying is that districts have to have access to financial capacity. There has to be suitable provision so that districts can make choices of programs to meet the high standards that the state has established.
And the state says that that's been done, that the districts involved in this litigation all meet or exceed the minimum state requirements. So why does that not, does that evidence not boot you out of court?
Your Honor, the accreditation system measures what it measures. But it doesn't pretend to measure all that schools do, and it frankly doesn't measure much beyond a few minimums.
Mr. Thompson,
beyond a few minimum requirements.
Which are the state's obligation as a policymaker to determine, is that correct?
The state has broad discretion to determine its ranking system or rating system or accreditation system for school districts. But it's our position, we have to remember that there are also state requirements for children. In the accreditation system, if two-thirds to three-fourths of the students can't get half the items right on math and science, the district...
But is the answer to that problem that the citizens of the state need to go to the legislature, vote out those who are not preparing their students adequately, vote in those who will raise the standards and the funding? I mean, is the answer a political answer rather than one that the courts are equipped to handle?
That is certainly part of the resolution, but that does not mean that there's not a role for this court. This court has previously said that the standards of Article 7, Section 1 are judicially interpretable and, more important, judicially enforceable. And frankly, it's the standard, the role of this court to set the constitutional standard. What is suitable provision within an efficient system for the purpose of providing the general diffusion of knowledge?
And Ms. Thompson, first of all, I'm not certain that getting all Texas students into Harvard is necessarily a good thing. But having said that, what evidence, if any, was presented at the lower court that more funding, throwing more dollars into this political problem, is going to resolve the issue? I've often heard that Washington, D.C. is well-funded. Those school districts are well-funded, but consistently their outputs are poor. So how is more funding the answer to this question?
Your Honor, the witnesses, expert witnesses, superintendents and others who testified, testified to a number of very specific areas in which expenditures are necessary to meet requirements by the state. As an example, again, the very first witness, Dr. Forgione, testified that his district, a new state requirement that, by the way, wasn't funded, is that districts have to develop individualized plans for all students who are at risk of falling behind or not meeting state requirements for advancement. Dr. Forgione testified that in his district alone, that was over 28% of the 6th through 12th graders, and the cost of that one requirement to his taxpayers was in the range of $1.2 million.
So do we look at the problems of the individual districts, or do we look at the system as a whole to determine if the state is meeting its constitution?
Your Honor, I think you have to look at both. We presented testimony by individual districts, and we presented evidence of a broader impact on the state as well.
Seems that no matter what the scheme may be, you can always find individual school districts that haven't met the state's burden. And then you would always have a cause of action and always be up here. The issue would never be resolved.
Your Honor, as we understand the state's standard, or the court standard, is that the issue is whether there is a substantial default. We believe that's the way this court has articulated it. We're not arguing for some type of strict liability standard. One district or one student could assert that.
The state says that's the same as rational basis.
We do not agree with that position. First of all, Your Honor, we do not believe this court has ever applied rational basis analysis to Article 7, Section 1. We believe you've been very careful not to do that, as other states have been.
Didn't we do that in Mum?
No, Your Honor.
I thought we interpreted
Excuse me.
Go ahead.
Mum is not an Article 7, Section 1 claim. There was no allegation in Mum that there was a violation of Article 7, Section 1. The claims in Mum, the Article 7 claim, was first a violation of Article 7, Section 5.
But we said, since the legislature has the mandatory duty to make a suitable provision for the support and maintenance of an efficient system of public schools, sounds a lot like Article 7, Section 1, then the legislature's determination of methods, restrictions, regulations is final, except when so arbitrary as to be violative of the constitutional rights of the citizens.
Yes, Your Honor. The issue in mind, once the court disposed of the Article 7, Section 5 claim, and turned your attention to the equal protection claim arising under Article 1, Section 3 of our Constitution, the question was the classification of districts into two categories, smaller and poorer and larger and wealthier, was that classification scheme violative of equal protection? The court looked to Article 7, Section 1 for authority of the legislature to make the classification in the first place. That's how Article 7, Section 1 came
into but we said the word suitable, used in connection with the word provision in this section of the Constitution, is an elastic term, depending upon the necessities of changing times, clearly leaves the legislature the right to determine what is suitable. Determination will not be reviewed by the courts if the act has a real relation to the subject and object of the Constitution. So you're saying everything we said there, that was just equal protection. The word suitable is not so elastic, and none of this applies if you just...
Your Honor, what I'm saying is the discussion in Mum about Section 1, the point that I think was being made with Section 1, was that if the legislature has a duty, it has to have a means to meet the duty, which we agree with. And if the classification was authorized by Section 1, in other words, if the legislature had the power to make the classification, and if that classification was not arbitrary, then there was no violation of the equal protection provision. So I think that's the context in which Section 1 is discussed in Mum. But again, Mum was not alleging a violation of Article 7, Section 1.
Well, I mean, it was a lot like it. It was a student in a property-rich district saying, a particular equalizing scheme, I'm not getting any of that money.
Right.
Which is a lot like what people are saying here.
But that claim was brought as an equal protection claim, which, again, this court, going back to Edgewood 1, has carefully avoided.
But as a practical matter, we have to give the legislature substantial deference. And what's the difference between substantial deference and just making sure what they do is not arbitrary?
Your Honor, we think the standard that this court has articulated of whether there is a substantial default in meeting a mandatory duty is the proper standard for this court and other courts to judge a legislative action under the suitable provision clause. The concern about rational basis is that we, from our view, the state is trying to lead the court into an area that the court has studiously avoided. And rational basis, as the court knows, is part of equal protection analysis where the choice is between rational basis or strict scrutiny. This court has very carefully avoided, in our understanding, an equal protection approach to this, and we would certainly urge you not to, in essence, backdoor an equal protection analysis by adopting a rational basis
figure. That was an issue in Edgewood 1.
Yes,
and, of course, we turned it down, but if we hadn't, what standard do you think would apply?
Your Honor, I don't know. First of all, I don't think Texas has ever, to my knowledge, considered the question of whether education is a fundamental right or not under our state constitution. I don't think we've been squarely presented with that issue. So
it seems like it. I mean, if it says general diffusion of knowledge is essential to the preservation of liberties and rights of the people, that sounds fairly fundamental.
It certainly sounds fundamental. And Your Honor, I think part of the reason why this court has been cautious in that area, I would direct the court's attention particularly to the recent Huckabee case in Arkansas and to the Bishop case in Arizona that have very good discussions about whether equal protection rational basis applies. I think the courts are concerned about applying every legislative action affecting education to strict scrutiny, and it was very interesting to me that both of those courts, after doing the analysis, said, you know, we don't have to get into that way of viewing this because there is a mandatory education clause that imposes an affirmative duty on the state, and it's simply a question for the court whether that duty has been met or not. The Bishop Court in Arizona actually noted that their court a couple of decades earlier had found that education was a fundamental right but applied rational basis. And I think the court finally said that doesn't make any sense. And so if in fact this court ever should approach the issue and look at the question of whether education is a fundamental right, we think it would be clear that strict scrutiny would apply, not rational basis.
Let me ask a somewhat different question. If the court were to conclude that the legislature has not appropriated what we determine to be sufficient funds to meet their constitutional obligation, would the court then be obligated to determine the correct amount and actually order the legislature to appropriate that amount?
Your Honor, we're not asking this court or the trial court to determine the right number, and we're definitely not asking as remedy for this court or any court to affirmatively invade the legislative
process. If we were to say that the funding is not appropriate, why would we not then have an obligation to give the legislature some idea of what an appropriate amount of funding would be?
Your Honor, I think guidance, as much guidance as can be given to the legislature, I think is always welcome. Probably the issue there would be where the court would get that information. Again, there were a number of different studies presented at trial using a variety of different methodologies to show different costs of meeting higher levels of performance. We certainly hope the state itself will take a comprehensive look at that. At the very outset, that should be a state responsibility to honestly look at the broad scope of requirements that are imposed in districts and decide what the cost is.
And then if we believe that the legislature has not gotten there, then the next time it addresses the issue and still has not adequately funded, then what, we appointed masters to make that determination? Do we take over the schools? I mean, how far does this go?
Your Honor, we believe the standard would always be a substantial default standard. So we do not envision this court, in essence, micromanaging every legislative appropriation.
But how do you get how do you get to the substantial default? Because I'm having a problem analyzing that when there's evidence, certainly from the state, or it's cited in the briefs, that schools have improved significantly since the last time this court has heard this issue. And yet you can correctly point out to isolated incidents in other school districts where they're failing. So how do we measure that?
Your Honor, we think if you look, first of all, whether there is a substantial default, and we believe this court has clearly said that if there is a substantial default, that violates the suitable provision clause. And we think you look at, if not this court, certainly a trial court would look at a variety of measures. Certainly one is output. And we have to respectfully but vigorously disagree with the state's perspective that things are fine. When you have performance on the passing requirement for 10th graders this year, where 39% of all students...
But that would have been a high pass rate under TOS. Those same questions would have yielded a 98% pass rate under TOS. So you're penalizing the state for raising the standards and phasing it in over time.
Your Honor, you're raising the standard, but I want to respectfully say for these students, you're not phasing it in. This is the standard that they will be held accountable to for graduation. And if you've
But the problem that we keep struggling with is that you could lower that standard and be out of the trap.
Right. And Your Honor, we support high standards. And in fact, the testimony we just need a funding system that is actually linked to and will support the high standards that we're establishing for all students.
If the state had stuck with TOS, would the system be adequate?
We don't believe so, Your Honor. And we do not fault and
why not? Because then you'd have a very high pass rate.
TOS had probably run its course. It had lived its life cycle as a testing instrument. It certainly was time to replace it.
But that's a policy question.
The policy question to move to a near high standard we completely support.
Okay, but you'd acknowledge
yes. What
test to give is a policy question.
Absolutely.
And so if the state had stuck with TOS and we were at a 98% pass rate, the system would be adequate.
We would not concede that, Your Honor. If the test, again, is a low standard that does not meet changing times, needs, and public
expectations. Even though you just said that's a policy question.
The test itself is a policy question. Simply keeping a test, we would not concede that that was the end of the discussion. Let me put it that way. If the state adopted an inadequate measure that did not meet the constitutional standard of general diffusion of knowledge, I don't want to concede that any measure the state adopted is solely beyond the review.
Well, you would concede, Mr. Cruz is correct, the percentage of students who pass is directly in proportion to how hard the test is.
I would agree with that, Your Honor.
So the fact that 75% of the students flunk the science exam doesn't really tell us that a school system's inadequate unless we know what all the questions were.
Your Honor, what it tells us and what the evidence was at trial is that if you go back to where we started with TOS, and TOS in its day was a harder instrument, you started with lower performance and performance gaps between student groups, but you had capacity in the system. And what the testimony shows is that over a decade period, scores went up because districts had the capacity to put resources into meeting the very programs that those students needed to improve. The difference where we are today with a new test is we have raised standards, performance gaps between student groups have reopened, at the very moment that most districts and most students in Texas are at their cap, there is no capacity.
For now. But the projections are it's going to steadily improve.
Not on the economic side. It's going to only get worse.
But in terms of outcomes.
Your Honor, the projection we think is overly optimistic that things will just magically keep getting better.
But I guess that leads to my next question. Is this really ripe for our review? If the standard has been raised and there's dispute over whether it's going to continue to rise or not, don't we have to wait and see?
Your Honor, we think it is right. We think the testimony, the evidence is that districts need to make investments now. And the state's own witnesses, their own experts conceded, you don't wait until October of a child's eighth grade year, spend a little money, and expect to get a measurable result in the spring of that year. Education is a cumulative
process. Mr. Thompson, if I can interrupt you just a moment and ask you a similar question to what I asked Mr. Cruz. The trial court in this case heard the evidence and has made findings that the state has not challenged. Among those findings, for example, is finding of fact 101. It says that the that the, in effect, that the districts are unable to meet the statutory regimen of accreditation, accountability, and assessment without taxing at or near the maximums. Now, is that a finding of fact that is supported by the evidence in your view, and are we bound by that in our review of what we're going to be of this case?
Your Honor, we believe that is a fact finding that was fully supported by the evidence, and we don't believe that those fact questions are before this court, and we believe the court should take those fact findings as unchallenged.
As conclusive, because they've not been challenged.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that they should bind us.
Yes, Your Honor.
Why isn't a solution to raise the cap and continue the basic recapture architecture of Senate Bill 7?
If the state wants to explore raising the property tax cap and continuing to shift the cost to local districts.
Shift the cost, local districts. If the district and the state are paying this amount, and because property values go like this between 89 and 75, and the state funding goes like this, one could look at it as, well, we've shifted the cost to the... Well, what we have really done is property values in Texas in 16 years have gone up a lot faster. The source you have for funding has gone up a lot faster
right.
than the state's sources for
right.
funding. So we didn't really shift to the counties. The counties just got richer faster, at least a lot of them. Your districts, for instance.
Your Honor, we did shift because under our school finance system, as values go up for schools, that does not translate into more money for education. It doesn't work the way it works with cities and counties. That money doesn't stay local. Increases in values accrue as savings to the state because they reduce the state obligation. And, in fact, the state looks to increases in values as a primary source of revenue into its funding stream each biennium.
So has the state real dollars taken out recapture from shifting property taxes around? What is the state funding more or less now of education?
The state share, if you look, Your Honor.
Not share. Is the state funding less?
In total dollars per student, the state contribution has gone down. In total dollars in the system, the state share, the state.
But some of those, because they took from your districts and gave to the other districts.
And Your Honor, we're growing in Texas by 80,000 students a year. We're adding a school district the size of Austin or Fort Worth every year in Texas. So a significant amount of revenue does go into paying for simply more students in the state. But if you look on an inflation-adjusted per-student basis, we think it is clear that local property taxes are carrying a much larger share of the overall cost than at any time in modern history.
Is your argument that there's a disproportionate share paid by the state, or that the state should increase its funding? If it's a straight state should increase its funding, at what point will the school districts be satisfied with the funding given by the state?
Your Honor, school districts are going to want every student in their district to be successful. So I hope we're never satisfied until we reach that goal. But from a funding standpoint, if we have a funding system, and if you think about the structure of Article 7, Section 1, suitable provision within an efficient system for the purpose of general diffusion of knowledge. If we have a system that, based upon state studies, comprehensive state studies, other information, establishes that there is a linkage or a relationship, and not just, as this court has said, on a funds left over basis, if there's a relationship between suitable provision and the great purpose of general diffusion of knowledge, I think districts are going to be slow to return to the court over that.
So you're content with raising the cap and keeping the Chapter 4142 basic architecture in place?
Your Honor, we're not advocating that. And, in fact, there are. I apologize for not fully answering your question.
Well, you got some.
If you do raise the cap, that is not a solution in and of itself. it's our reading, particularly of this court's prior decisions, that if you do raise the cap, districts don't automatically tax to whatever the new cap is. They have to have elections within their communities to access that new authority. Frankly, those are going to pass in some districts. They're not going to pass in other districts. And so what you would wind up with, if you raise the cap, it is probably exacerbating some disparities, increasing recapture, increasing reliance on local property taxes, and that is not a solution that we recommend.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The court will now take a brief recess.
All right.
The court is now ready to hear argument from the Appalachian Edgewood Independent School District.
May it please the court, Mr. David G. Hinojosa will open with 10 minutes of argument for Appalachian Edgewood Independent School District et al. Mr. Buckwood will then present 10 minutes of argument for Appalachian Alvarado Independent School District et al. And finally, Mr. Ted Cruz will conclude today's argument with 15 minutes of rebuttal for Appellant Neely et al.
May it please the court. The Edgewood districts, a group of 22 property poor districts, stand before this court because the state has retreated from the remedy that it granted the more than 800 property poor districts in its opinions of Edgewood 1 through Edgewood 4. This court has protected the property poor districts and held the state accountable to our Constitution by directing the legislature to provide a general diffusion of knowledge to all students in an efficient and suitable manner. This court cannot follow the state's lead and reverse course now, not only because our state cannot afford it, but because our Constitution does not allow it. The trial court considered 5.5 weeks of testimony from dozens of witnesses, over 7,000 trial exhibits.
Were there any parents, children from Edgewood that testified?
No, Your Honor. But I would like
Why is that not a standing problem?
That's not a standing problem because under the NUTSI standard that the court used in West Orange Code, as we see it, the districts have been delegated the responsibility, not necessarily to say that that duty has escaped our legislature, but they have been delegated the responsibility of providing a general diffusion of knowledge to each and every one of their students. And now they are at that point where they have been acting with that particular authority. They don't have the resources that have followed in order to carry out that particular duty. So therefore, the harm is there. And then secondly, a remedy by this court can, address the harm that they've suffered.
But normally, we're concerned about this, like in class actions, because, for instance, as I read the court's, Judge Dietz's findings about what's inadequate, you all could reach an agreement with the state to eliminate all that. The state says we'll pay bigger bilingual stipends, bigger salaries, bigger signing bonuses, bigger money for in-service training, and you all agree it's all adequate, and you all districts could agree to that because that's all the evidence you put on for what was inadequate, with the exception of facilities. Putting that aside, there were some striking shortcomings on facilities. But as far as maintenance and operations, you all could agree to that, and yet the people in Edgewood might say, we weren't here for librarians. We were here for something else.
I believe the board is the one who passed the resolution of all the school districts so that they could bring this suit forth, and that board is representative of the community.
Well, but the fact of the matter is the school employee, you ask the employees of any outfit what would make this a better place to work, they generally say higher salaries. If you ask the people who buy from the business, they will say lower prices. And so when we say, what will make the schools better? If all we ask is school employees, we may get a different answer than we would get from if we asked school consumers.
Yes, Your Honor. I don't believe that it's quite that simple. I don't think that, you know, we're looking at the system as a whole, and whether or not the state has retreated from its duty to provide a general diffusion of knowledge, you know, and have those resources available so that every single child in all of those districts can benefit, and that's how they will benefit.
Well, let's not put too fine a point on it. Probably there's some of your residents in Edgewood. What is the spending per pupil in Edgewood currently, roughly?
Roughly from the state revenue resources?
Everything.
Everything, it would be above probably $5,000.
And probably there might be some people in the district who would say, give me $3,500 and I'll take them home, teach them myself, take them to private school. But of course, the school district would rather fall on their swords than suggest school choice, right?
Well, I think that that's a policy decision that's better left to
right.
our legislature.
Right, so that's my point. If the people in Edgewood thought it would be better for suitable provision for our education of our kids just to give us the money, even if it's less, your school district couldn't represent those because that's the last thing you all want.
That still doesn't take away from the aspect of whether or not the districts have demonstrated a real controversy that will actually be determined by this court. And that's the particular test we're standing on. And I'd also like to mention that in Edgewood 4, MALDEF represented school districts, not school children in that particular lawsuit.
Of course, that was a tax lawsuit. That wasn't an adequacy suit.
I believe it was also an equity lawsuit.
Not here.
An efficiency? I believe that there was an Article 7, Section 1, and the court did address the facilities and the maintenance and operations side of the equation.
Mr. Hinojosa, if you look at the system as a whole that you just said, why wouldn't the court apply a rational basis test to determine whether or not the system in itself fails or passes?
This court has never applied a rational basis test in reviewing these Article 7, Section 1 claims.
So why can't we do that now?
Because we have a test already that is sufficient, reviewing the system as a whole, determining whether or not there's a substantial default. There's no reason to go down to the standard where all the state would have to provide is some sort of relation to the ultimate goal. And when you look at the state accreditation system, the way it was set up, just so that every district, and this is the state's own witness, Dr. Clute, stated this, it's set up so that every single district can meet the accreditation standards. It's not so that every single child can be provided a general diffusion of knowledge. They've missed that particular point in setting that accreditation system.
Why aren't they hooked together?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Why aren't they hooked together? Why don't you think they're hooked together?
Because it's easier to fund an accredited education under their very low standards than it is to fund a general diffusion of knowledge for every single child.
Under their higher standards.
Under the lower accreditation standards, the simple fact that you can have 16% of the students pass a science test and still be accredited.
But it looks to me like, as I asked earlier, if you just gave an easier test, then 100% would pass, but the kids wouldn't know anymore.
But at the same time, they've lowered the cut scores so low on this particular test. You know, they're demonstrating a 42% proficiency rate in deeming.
Again, that was a particularly policy-driven decision. To start out at two cuts below and then move it up over time so the districts won't feel like they're doomed for failure at the outset. Isn't that a policy choice that we aren't involved in? And let me ask you as well, my understanding was that Edgewood was not really challenging the accountability system as representing a general diffusion of knowledge. It was not having the means to get there.
I think it's both, Your Honor. I think that, you know, this court has established a presumption that the accreditation system provides a general diffusion of knowledge, but we provided overwhelming evidence as found by the trial court that we rebutted that particular presumption.
But I thought that your argument was that not enough kids were getting to that measure as opposed to challenging the measure itself.
I think it was a twofold. One is that certainly what is required of a general diffusion of knowledge, that's a quality, access to a quality education that enables every child to fully participate in the educational, social, and economic opportunities. It also meets the changing times, needs, and expectations. And when you have, that's certainly higher than what an accreditation system accounts for. And then on top of that, we don't have the resources to meet that higher level for all of our districts.
So if 100% of district students passed TOCs, met the completion rate and the dropout rate, you'd say that still there was no general diffusion?
No, Your Honor. What we're saying is that
So you don't quarrel with the standards. You're just saying the standards aren't being met.
The standard for the individual student is to pass all of those tests, is to become proficient. And when those students are able to take advantage of the full TEKS curriculum, when they're able to take advantage of the state's default recommended high school program, when they're able to take advantage of extracurricular and co-curricular activities, only then. But at the level of funding that the state has right now, particularly for low-income and limited English proficient children, the level of funding is set arbitrarily so low. The state studies came back, the state's own expert came in and had a study, and they said, well, how much will it take to bring up 55% of the students at 2 SEM below, 2 standard errors of measurement, below the standard that we believe that you should have? And they said, well, we're only going to look at reading and math. We're going to look at 2 SEM below. How much more is it going to take to bring up these limited English proficient? Because it's the testimony, the state didn't refute the testimony that, you know, it does cost additional resources. And in fact, they do provide additional resources. But when you look at their level of funding, the latest study, the state expert recommended $1,900. It's going to cost $1,900 to bring up this low-income child just to meet these minimal standards in this particular test that we've set. And then it's going to cost over $1,200 to bring up a limited English proficient. Did the state go ahead and follow that? No, the state did not. It continued to fund at rates that were already arbitrarily set well below the recommended weights from another study back in the 1980s. And it follows the same thing with facilities where they haven't even addressed that issue.
Counsel, you cite numbers that are internal to the state, comparisons to accreditation levels from the legislature and state board, comparisons to passage of test passage rates internal to the state that you think indicate that the education system is not doing so well. The state, at least in argument today, cites comparisons between our state and other states. What is the more relevant comparison? Which should we pay more attention to? The fact that Texas is doing well compared to New Jersey, or how Texas is doing compared to our internal standards, and why?
Well, I think that if you look at New Jersey, and if you were to even compare our state,
that was just an example.
Okay.
I'm not saying I didn't pick that for any particular reason.
Okay. Well, one, you have to look to particular state standards because there's high stakes. There's high stakes for kids to graduate and meet all of these standards. That means pass all the curriculum that they must take. That means passing the tax exam. That means being able to access those particular resources that are necessary to keep that child in school, get that child to achieve at the level, not just 25% of the kids to pass one particular test. And when you look at LEP children in particular, they're not even part of the accreditation system as a disaggregated subgroup. You know, they're lumped together, you know, possibly with Hispanics or other disaggregated groups that they might belong to. But in the end, when the state cites the NAEP test scores and about how great they've come, one, that's a selected, they have a selected number of students. Only 2,000 students, I believe, took those particular tests that they mentioned.
But nevertheless, it's the gold standard by your own witness.
I'm not sure if that was by our witness, Your Honor, but that was a witness in the trial. Not sure we put up a witness that would say that, especially given the fact that in state, our state holds every single child to the same standards. says, no matter how you come to us, you're going to have to meet the same standards. Unlike the NAEP test, where the results that the state touts is after they control for certain, you know, economic factors. Our state doesn't do that. Our state doesn't give no affirmative action points for that. We're not saying you need to give affirmative action points or anything like that for this. But if you want us to meet standards, the testimony and the numerous findings of fact show that given the proper amount of resources, these students can achieve. They can succeed. And all at the same levels. We can close the achievement gap in that respect.
Are there further questions?
I got one question. Is the issue the proper amount of resources, or is it the issue the resources aren't allocated properly in the local school districts?
I don't think, Your Honor, I don't believe that there was any findings of fact made by the trial court.
Well, there's some discussion about expenditures on slides and swimming pools to keep students interested.
Yes, I recognize that, and exactly how minute that particular project cost, I'm not too sure.
But how can that be determined?
It's one isolated event, and there were no findings made by the trial court.
Very well, but how can that be determined here if those expenditures were not segregated by the trial court?
We didn't try necessarily a tax case. What we put on evidence was this is what our districts are spending, and we focus primarily on the limited English proficient and low-income children because that's where their true failings are. You have 7 out of 10 LEP students failing the 5th grade standardized test, and you have 8 out of 10 failing the 8th and 11th grade test, you know. And then you have the superintendents and experts coming in saying, look, this is what's required to bring up this child up to these standards. But the districts are having to basically rob Peter to pay Paul. And they shouldn't have to do that, not when we're talking about the quality of the education that our children receive.
Was there any evidence at the trial court to rebut that?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor.
And so we take that finding of fact as to be conclusive, as Justice Johnson stated?
Yes, Your Honor. And there was no challenge to these particular findings, as Justice Johnson pointed out earlier by the trial court.
Chief, could I ask a couple of questions? Mr. Hinojosa, I'm looking at a map here of Bexar County, where Edgewood is. Appears to me, if you drive around Loop 410, you pass through 14 different school districts, about one every two exits, apparently. Has Edgewood, the injunction you're asking for is equitable relief. Of course, to get equity, you've got to do equity. In the 40 years Edgewood District has been filing lawsuits, has Edgewood ever considered trying to consolidate with San Antonio School District?
I believe there was testimony, Your Honor, by Dr. Christine Drennan, who talked about how the different districts developed, you know, because of residential segregation that they had and economic segregation within the city. And there was testimony that Edgewood had tried to consolidate with, I'm not sure if it was Alamo Heights, but it was with San Antonio ISD at one time. But SAISD said no.
Any time in the last 10 years or so?
I'm not aware of that, Your Honor.
And so that would certainly raise the average property value per student available to Edgewood if they consolidated with downtown San Antonio.
Yeah, and that would also probably likewise lower the property value of San Antonio Independent School District, and they would have more needy students. And since these students are being underfunded by the state, probably not much of an option for SAISD.
I understand two things on that. Number one, if you consolidate districts, the state has to give extra funds to the new district to make up for what you're getting currently. The state has to make some allocation for that.
Yes,
right?
Sir.
And number two, if the state can make you do that if the school's academically unacceptable. They can make you consolidate. They did with Wilmer Hutchins, in fact, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So the fact of the matter is, if instead of putting a floor down here at 25% of people pass, if they raise it to something like what's been suggested, 50 or 75%, pretty soon they could make Edgewood join San Antonio. And that would equalize, to some degree, the funding disparity in Texas. If we made tiny school districts that are rich and tiny school districts that are poor consolidate with districts that are more in between.
That might be an option that our legislature can consider, but it still doesn't solve the fact, because then you're going to be dependent on the whims of the constituents, you know, whether or not they want to vote to have a consolidation.
Well, I mean, how fair is it? You're here asking for equity. How fair is it to say we refuse to join with a richer district, but we want some of their money?
I don't believe that that's necessarily an argument, Your Honor. The Supreme Court has already stated that all districts must have substantially equal access to similar revenue at similar tax efforts.
And joining with a bigger district with a lot of revenue would do that.
And that's a possibility, yes, but it still doesn't resolve the...
And again, who would object to consolidating? We keep the people going to the same elementary schools, probably the same teachers. There's more property value per person. The only people that lose their jobs are probably some administrators, right? Who are the only ones we have present in court objecting?
Well, it just might be some of the property wealthy districts. I'm not so sure. Maybe we can ask Highland Park and whether or not they would like to consolidate with Dallas ISD and absorb some of that. And it's still not going to resolve
Highland
the
Park's
fact
not
that
here objecting they don't have enough property. You are.
Well, and we're not necessarily objecting that we don't have enough property. We're objecting to the fact that our districts are not provided the standard that this court has set, and that's substantially equal access to similar revenue, a similar tax effort. We understand it's not going to be a per capita distribution, but these are countless children that enter those doors of those schools every single day during the school year. And why should they be held to a much lower standard? All we're doing is saying, level the system up. We're not talking about leveling the system down. We're talking about leveling it up so that all children can at least have access to the opportunities that present themselves. No more limitations. We're beyond that. We should be beyond that because this court has held that we're beyond that, but yet the state continues to fund in its arbitrary manner. You know, the state really needs to look at this.
Thank you, Mr. Reynolds.
Thank you.
Yes. Thank you, Counselor. Any further questions? The court then is ready to hear argument from Mr. Wood for the Alvarado Independent School District.
May it please the court. This court has instructed the litigants in all of these cases that you're going to look at the system as a whole. We're not supposed to be saying, well, there's this little problem over here and this little problem over here. We're supposed to look at the system as a whole. And this court has said the state must provide a general diffusion of knowledge to its students. Didn't say that it's supposed to provide a general diffusion of knowledge to some of its students. Now, can all students perform? No. But let's talk about what the evidence below is and is really undisputed. Is this state providing a general diffusion of knowledge to its students in this state when over 30% of the students never graduate from high school?
Under what scenario would the state meet its burden? Under what scenario would the state meet its burden?
The state,
providing a general diffusion of knowledge.
The state would have to at least graduate the vast majority of their kids from high school. They're not doing that. That is, if nothing else, if this court says that the state is providing a system that's adequate and it's dropping out probably 40% of Hispanic students, somewhere in that neighborhood of African-American students, and probably 25% of its Anglo students. Those kids are, by definition, not getting a general diffusion of knowledge. The state's own witnesses agree to that.
Well, I presume that depends upon how you measure dropout. I mean, getting a GED equivalency, do you count that in the dropout rate? Someone moves from the state, you would count that in the dropout rate. I understand there's a big argument as to what is an accurate dropout rate.
There is an argument only because, let me back up. The last United States Census showed that Texas has a net in-migration of students. We get more students coming in than we do leaving. I don't care whether they go to Mexico or out of state. We have a net in-migration of students. So we got more students year to year to year in Texas than we had the year before. Now, we are, by the state's own calculations, and certainly by the calculations that that this court could even do, you can go look at the eighth grade population in Texas 5 years ago and look at the 12th grade graduation, and you're going to find there's 620-some-odd thousand students that aren't graduating. But we know, if you hold everything even, we know that we got more students coming in than we do leaving. So it makes no real difference what reason that they might give for leaving. We're losing 600-some-odd thousand students between the 8th grade and the 12th grade. And when you figure that out, that's a dropout rate.
Makes no difference. What if an indigent family wants a 16-year-old to start working? Now, I understand that you and I wouldn't want our 16-year-old to do that, but if a very poor family wanted them to help support the family, you're saying we need a school district that says, absolutely not. You get back to school right now.
But our law absolutely requires that. Truancy laws say you can't make that decision.
With the parent's consent.
Making a difference with the parent's consent. The truancy is truancy. The fact is, we are losing that number of students between the 8th grade and the 12th grade. Are we providing, do we have a system that's providing a general diffusion of knowledge?
Counsel, doesn't that depend on your definition of adequacy? If the state defined adequacy, and assuming adequacy is justiciable, and they defined it to be an 8th grade education, then your statistics would not prove a substantial default. It comes down to your definition of adequacy and what's required under the Constitution. The state's taking the position in our argument today that their text requirement, DEKS, and their recommended high school program are not required by the Constitution, that those mandates from the state board and the state legislature are much higher than any constitutional requirement. The adequacy requirement in the Constitution, assuming it's justiciable, the state has told us today, is basic minimum education. In a minute, I'm going to ask exactly what that means. So their definition of adequacy is a much different one than yours. One of our fundamental questions today is, who gets to pick which definition is to be followed? The legislature or the courts, or the legislature with court oversight in judging whether the legislative decision satisfies the constitutional standard? So I hear your argument, but you're glossing over a fundamental question here.
This court, in this case, West Orange Code stated the legislature may not define what constitutes a general diffusion of knowledge so low as to avoid its obligation to make a suitable provision as imposed by this Constitution.
And that adds some meat to the bone. But what does that mean?
We have testimony of the state, undisputed, that in developing the TOCS test, they went into a tremendous amount of evidence that test was developed by the state in an attempt to measure whether or not the child was getting a general diffusion of knowledge.
Let me go back.
That's their development. They went through the development. That's the state's definition of what's a general diffusion.
My impression has been from the briefing that you don't quarrel with the accountability system as it is. Your quarrel is with the number of students who can meet that system.
No, that is not our position.
So you said the text.
That is not our position.
100% of students passing text, meeting the dropout standards, meeting the completion rates, if 100% of students met that, you say that's still not a general diffusion.
Well, what we have here is an accountability system.
Exactly, that's my point.
But the accountability system is being implemented in such a way that it allows these vast discrepancies, both in test scores.
So you don't dispute the measure of adequacy. You dispute the number of students who can reach it.
I dispute the way the accountability system, my clients dispute the way the accountability system is being applied. In other words, we don't have any unaccredited districts except one or two in the whole state. We hold these students on these tests. We hold these students 100% to that test. But we don't hold these districts to accountability, anything like that. which it's already been discussed, and I want to go back. I don't want to go back over it, but if I'm a student in the school system, I have held to that test, being able to pass all of those tests that's required of me in order to be able to be promoted. We don't do anything like that to school districts. Now, I'm not suggesting that there should be wholesale unaccredited school districts in Texas, but I will say the way the accountability system has been implemented and has continued to be implemented is to make certain that there are almost no unaccredited school districts or unacceptable school districts. What does that tell the legislature? That tells the legislature they don't need to do anything. In actuality, those standards are so low that they are allowing the school districts of Texas to be accredited when they are not delivering a general diffusion of knowledge.
Counsel, you said that some of these higher standards mandated by the legislature and the school board or the state board were put in place in order to satisfy the general diffusion of knowledge requirement. Is that in a statute? Where is that?
That's delegated to the Texas Education Agency by the legislature. So to the extent that it's in rule,
where's the tie-in? Where's the statement that the legislature tied these higher standards to the constitutional general diffusion of standard of education standard? Where is that stated? Is that in a statute?
Well, of course, we have the general statutory provision 4001, which sets out the general what the state's goals are. You can call them aspirational. The state then took that statutory goal, developed an accountability system that's supposed to meet that goal. And what we're saying is they're allowing school districts, because they're not really enforcing the accountability system, they're allowing school districts not to meet those standards and all be accredited. Now, I'd like to turn one quick, because we've talked about equity, a major thrust of my clients. We have been in every equity case, and these started in 1986. It wasn't quite 40 years ago.
Well, San Antonio versus Rodriguez was almost exactly.
That was not. I'm talking about the state school finance equity cases. What has happened is that we're all sitting here talking about adequacy, and certainly that's part of our case. We're talking about financial equity, both at M&O. Which is management operations and facilities. We've talked about a little bit about the facilities. It's really, that issue seems to me to be pretty clear cut. In Edgewood Ford, this court said you can have a 9-cent gap. You can have some unequalized enrichment between the poorest districts and the richest districts. And that barely was constitutional as viewed through the prism of history. And that the state must do better. The undisputed evidence as far as equity is concerned, M&O equity is concerned, by the state's own expert, that 9 cents is now 17 cents. So not only has the state not done better, it has done worse, much worse. The inequity is between the richest districts and the poorest districts have basically doubled. And that is a critical point that we ask this court to address, because it's said in Edgewood Ford, we'll permit 9 cents, but you got to do better. Well, they've done worse.
Well, Judge Dietz opined that the M&O was constitutionally sound. Aren't there other factors that go into the difference between the 9 cents and the 17 cents, like inflation and other expenditures?
No, the state's own this analysis has been going on.
So anything over 9 cents is bad?
Well, the Supreme Court seemed to say so in Edgewood Ford. I mean, it did say so. It said, we'll allow 9 cents, but that's barely meets the standard, and only because you've made a lot of progress in equity. You must do better. Well, now it's 17 cents, and that's not really, there's no real argument about that.
Any further questions? Thank you, Kelsey.
Thank you.
Chief Justice, and may it please the court, in rebuttal I'd like to raise 6 points. But
Mr. Cruz, can you address the issue that I just asked counsel on this 9 cents versus 17 cents? Judge Dietz's opinion that the MNO is constitutionally sound?
With respect to equity, both concerning facilities and MNO, as an initial matter, both of the interveners attempt to avoid the clear holding of Edgewood 4, which is that financial efficiency is required only up to the extent of qualitative efficiency, which is adequacy, which means that once the court determines adequacy has been provided, that the core of Article 7, Section 1, a general diffusion of knowledge, is present, then the system is presumptively equitable. And beyond that, the court has said repeatedly, starting in Edgewood 2, again in Edgewood 3, again in Edgewood 4, that local supplementation is allowed above and beyond. Mr. Thompson began by saying there was testimony that there was a correlation between dollars and results. And the word correlation was very carefully chosen because the testimony did not say there was any causation between the two, simply that there had been a correlation. And indeed, Justice Cornyn, writing alone in Edgewood 3 and writing for the court in Edgewood 4, explicitly rejected the premise as being a disputed policy matter on which there was no clear legal answer as to whether more money yields better results. But focusing specifically on the results, Justice Wainwright asked, we looked at the other states, what about Texas? Looking just at Texas and looking, for example, at Dallas ISD, one of the Walk districts, in 2003, the 10th grade tax results, in English, 58% of the 10th graders passed the English test. The next year, 2004, those same students, now in 11th grade, that went from 58% to 84%. In 1 year, those students rose and cleared the higher bar. In math, it went from 45% in 10th grade to 79% the next year in 11th grade. In science, from 36% in 10th grade to 78% in 11th grade.
How do you address the statement that Mr. Woods made that just seems like a pretty powerful statement? How can you call a system adequate when 30% of students don't graduate?
Well, focusing on dropouts, there are several responses. First of all, the method the state uses to calculate dropouts is an actual count. We go and physically count every student, and if a student doesn't show up, we require the districts to go and find out why. That is surely a rational system. The Alvarado and Edgewood districts
asked... What percentage of dropout does that assessment yield?
That yields a rolling dropout of, depending on accreditation, between 1% and 2%. But it is surely rational to require an actual count versus what the Edgewood and Alvarado districts ask for, which is an estimation. An estimation is an acceptable way to do it, but it can't be irrational to go and physically count. And indeed, the superintendents for every plaintiff district testified that when they go and count, they report those numbers accurately. So the plaintiffs themselves are saying their numbers are accurate, but at the same time they're saying don't count our own numbers, count the estimation. I would point out that there was unrefuted expert testimony that using the federal standard of dropouts, which is what Texas uses, Texas is first in the nation on dropouts, controlling for socioeconomic factors. That is surely not irrational. The same increased results from 10th to 11th grade are present with Alvarado, one of the property poor districts, where you have English going from 66% to 87, math from 50% to 90, science from 47% to 92, social studies from 71% to 96. But even focusing just on minority and economically disadvantaged children, which is much of where the interveners focus their attention. Looking at the statewide results on that, the results are compelling. From 2003 to 2005, the 11th grade tests, African Americans in math went from 52% to 67%. In English, from 59% to 84%. In science, from 52% to 68%. The same pattern is true for Hispanic students. The same pattern is true for economically disadvantaged students.
Assuming all those are correct and focusing on the tax issue, can we conclude that the reason for these successes is increased spending by the districts up to the $1.50 level to meet the requirements that the state has has given in the last few years.
To conclude that, Mr. Chief Justice, there would need to be evidence of causation, and there is no evidence of causation. One of the things Mr. Thompson said is he pointed to the fact that the district, some districts have had to cut their budget. But the districts are not immune from ordinary budget pressures, which particularly in 2002-2003, when there was a national economic downturn, many organizations, statewide, governmental, private organizations, faced budgetary pressures. One point to keep in mind, in 1995, the cap for all M&O and all facilities was $1.50. Since that time, the state has broken facilities out and given another 50 cents for facilities. So the cap that is comparable to Edgewood 4 is now $2. It's not $1.50 because the $1.50 is just M&O now, and there's another 50 cents on top of it. So between 1995 and the present, in 10 years, the cap has risen 50 cents. But what the districts are saying is they should not face budgetary pressures. They should never have to cut their budget. It's interesting Mr. Thompson focused on Austin. The same year Austin was cutting its budget, it made the discretionary decision to give its teachers a pay raise. Now, that may be a terrific policy decision, but it's clearly a policy decision. And the question is not whether there's waste. We don't take issue with waste or not. The question, as it concerns the tax claim, is state control. And the state is clearly not controlling either the assessment of the tax or the disbursement of the tax.
But would you agree that most of the school districts around the state are operating at or near their financial capacity?
That is true that most of the districts around the state, two-thirds of the districts around the state, have chosen to tax at $1.45 or above.
And so all these gains that we've seen about test scores that you've just related, where do we go from here? Where do they go then in terms of future improvements in the scoring?
There is no necessary connection between increased spending and increase results. Some of the districts that are producing the best results have not increased their tax rates correspondingly, and some of the districts that are producing the worst results have increased.
Well, is that because they have a bigger property tax base to tax from, or is it because they're using their resources better?
Well, given that the system is largely equalized, the property tax base has a limited impact. And so at the end of the day, there was considerable testimony and there's considerable national evidence that there are many other factors to go into producing results rather than just money.
Council, let me ask you, make sure I'm clear. If you assume adequacy is justiciable, adequacy is defined, I think you said, by basic minimum education. Given that definition, then, the tax requirement, the recommended high school program, and those other requirements go beyond the constitutional requirement. When I asked you earlier what the parameters are under the Constitution, I think you got diverted, didn't get to answer it, but based on your other comments, I think you'd say there are no constitutional parameters that can be enforced in the judicial system, correct?
That's correct.
So then, there are no parameters legally in the justice system for what the legislature can or cannot require, can or cannot allow with regard to the quality of public school education. Is that based on your position? Is that correct?
That is not necessarily correct. If the court determines adequacy is justiciable, there is, under this court's precedence, an assessment of rational basis.
So there's my question presumed your position that adequacy was not justiciable.
If adequacy is not justiciable, then there is not a standard that can be applied in court. It is still a real constitutional obligation upon the legislature. And it's worth noting, actually, the Huckabee decision, which Mr. Thompson referenced.
Let's come to that in a second. So then the only restraint on the quality of education for public schools in Texas, assuming adequacy is not justiciable, is political guidance, political punishment, or political actions by the people who elect the legislature.
Well, that and the assumption that this court would no doubt make that the legislature will carry out its constitutional duties. The Constitution gives it to the legislature. And as a coordinate branch of government, it is not a reasonable presumption for this court to presume that the legislature is not going to take seriously carrying out its constitutional duty.
So if the legislature decided that basic minimum education was a fourth grade education, then there's nothing this court could do about it, in your opinion, according to the state?
If the matter was non-justiciable, there would not be
a
legal action
in
court. The answer is yes, but if that happened, there would be protests in the street. The system, that would not end the decision.
Well, certainly, there are political considerations, but the state's position is, because adequacy is not justiciable, the legislature could require that the constitutional standard the people adopted for general diffusion of knowledge is a fourth grade education, and there's nothing this court could do about it. That's the state's position.
Justice Wainwright, that is correct, and that is inherent in saying something's a political question. Anytime the court says something is a political question, which is a commonplace notion in federal law, in Texas law, anytime the court does that, it does mean that the political actor to whom it's entrusted could conceivably do some horrible hypothetical. But because it's a political question, it's not the role of the courts to correct those horrible hypotheticals.
I certainly agree. The court should only act within its proper role. However, traditionally, constitutional provisions, particularly, for instance, the Bill of Rights in the U.S. Constitution, which protects rights, provides checks and parameters on the political system, equal protection, takings, free speech. You're saying here the constitutional standard in Article 7, Section 1, provides no such parameters, even though the people established those standards.
That is incorrect. The checks and balances both work both ways. And the political question doctrine is a check and balance on the judiciary. It is notable that the Arkansas decision, the Huckabee decision Mr. Thompson referenced, explicitly distinguished Arkansas's constitution from the constitutions in Alabama, Pennsylvania, Florida, and Rhode Island, because all of those, like Texas, assign the responsibility for education to the legislature. They explicitly specify the legislature. And Arkansas said our constitution doesn't assign it to the legislature. It assigns it to the state. And there's a difference between a constitutional language that textually assigns it to a coordinate branch of government and constitutional language that makes it a general obligation.
Let me ask you quickly about facilities funding.
Yes.
Would you agree that property poor districts do not have substantially equal access or substantially similar access to facilities funding? My understanding is you argue that has to be district specific. Why should that be different from M&O funding?
What we argue with respect to facilities is there needs to be some demonstration of comparable difference in need, because facilities needs are not distributed uniformly.
Well, but neither are M&O needs in a way. I mean, an argument's been made that districts have specific needs that M&O funds address. And why is that same analysis not applicable to facilities? In other words, why are facilities so different that we take it out of the Edgewood construct?
Because the court has assumed with regard to M&O that costs are roughly equal, that M&O needs are roughly equal. With regard to facilities, such a high portion of it is sunk costs. It depends upon what building is there already. And some districts have great buildings, some districts have lousy buildings, but there's not a uniform need that exists in the abstract. Moreover, the Edgewood and Alvarado districts repeatedly refused to address Edgewood 4's square holding that financial efficiency only applies up to the level of a general diffusion of knowledge. And finally, with regard to facilities, it is important to keep in mind that the system equalizes 29 cents above $1.50, the first 29 cents of facility funding, through the EDA and the IFA. The EDA in particular, which is the existing debt allotment, since 1999, has allocated consistently between $400 and $500 million a year, and the legislature has never once failed to roll those funds over from when it was enacted, which means a district can pass a bond, make one payment, and they automatically qualify for equalized funds under the EDA.
I've got two questions. Just briefly, we have asked whether the case might have been tried differently if there had been individual plaintiffs. Do you think it would have been?
It may well. For example, in Edgewood 4, there were individual plaintiffs who specifically sought as a remedy school choice. And that was a remedy that those individual plaintiffs believed would fix the system more than would more money to the district.
But still, they were arguing for unconstitutionality.
They were.
And the commissioner or the comptroller is under injunction as of October 1st not to further fund the public school system. In the past, when the court has concluded that there was a constitutional violation, the state has had anywhere from a couple of years to a couple of weeks to do something about it. Obviously, the deadline now is a couple of months away. Does the state have any view at this point, if it should lose the case, on any one of the several grounds that are argued, how that deadline impinges on the school year or function of the schools?
As an initial matter, it's our judgment that the district court's injunction is stayed by operation of our appeal. So we do not view the October 1st deadline as constraining this court. In terms of remedies, if the court were to conclude that this were an unconstitutional state tax, there would be several remedies open to the court. One remedy, which you suggest Justice Heck, would be striking the state cap, and that would be in some ways the cleanest remedy. A second remedy would be striking the cap district by district for each of the 1,029 districts that could demonstrate that they were at or lacking meaningful discretion below the cap. Or the third remedy, and the one that the court has employed in past Edgewood decisions when it has struck down the system, would be to enjoin the entire system and leave it to the legislature to determine what to do from there.
But on time frames, I guess it's anybody's notion how time affects this.
With respect to time frame, the Office of Attorney General certainly urges the court to decide this matter as swiftly as possible. And I think the fact that the court has set an expedited briefing schedule and argument indicates that the court is of the same judgment.
Thank you, Kevin.
One other question, Chief. What is the effect, in your opinion, of the governor's vetoing the public school budgets? How does that play into your position?
At least right now, this case was tried on a litigated record and presents a case to this court. And so I do not suggest it impacts the arguments in this court, other than to say that the legislature is grappling with these issues right now. To say this is a general question is not illusory, and that the political branches are certainly wrestling with it. If it so happens that the legislature chooses to substantially change the school finance plan, I have no doubt that what would be appropriate would be for the parties to submit supplemental briefs at that time, assessing the impact of whatever might happen. But unless and until something happens, it's not feasible to speculate how that might impact the case.
Thank you, Mr. Cruz. These causes are submitted, and the marshal will now adjourn the court.
All rise. Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay.